I'm good to go when you are.
We're rolling.
All right. What's up? Oh, wait. No, it's festive. Ho, ho, ho. Happy New Year. What's up? It's Movies On Up. No one gets off until he does. I am Dave, joined by my jolly co-host, Ryan.
I don't know what the complimentary festive greeting is because you used ho, ho, ho. And
Happy Mary. New Year.
Happy New Year.
Ho, ho, ho to say we hope you enjoyed your Christmas.
We hope, hope, hope.
Happy. No, too far. You took it too far. Happy New Year to say welcome to 2016, our first episode that we're recording in 2016. I think the uppies went up in 2016, but
I'm not sure. I think they went up in 2015.
Okay.
I got them up before the ball went down.
Then our first official episode of
2016, the year of our Lord.
Yeah.
The year we made contact.
And it is, of course, a look back at 2015 and our favorite movies of the year. We tend to mix it up. We used to do our own individual top tens, and then last year we did a collective top 10. This year, we're back to the old way.
So we don't share well.
Yeah, so we're each going to go through our list of top 10 movies of 2015. Overall, like ignoring the elephant in the room, which was Star Wars, like what do you feel of the year in movies? Like when you were coming across your list, what's your overall feeling on?
I mean, not even so much my list, because I guess that's a bit different. What I think about the year in general is just the ridiculous amount of money that people spent. Obviously, two giant movies in Jurassic World and one which may be on. I don't think that one's on either of our lists, but
no.
There's one that is. The amount of money spent to watch those two movies, historical, completely unprecedented. You have a great box office year if you have one of those movies.
Oh, yeah.
But to have two of them.
Two of the top four movies of ever?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't need to do the math on that, but I would be willing to assume that that would make 2015 the highest grossing year ever. I can't imagine
plus
a scenario.
Plus, the big hitters, Avengers, Inside Out, like there was Minions, like there was a lot of.
Oh, and there was a Hunger Games movie. I mean, there was a lot of movies that were in that $200 to $300 million range, which is a great take at the box office. It just so happens this year that we had two movies that made over $600 million, and one of them did that in 3 weeks.
Yeah, Avatar. Is Abadah. The all time leading. It made its money in 234 days, I think.
Right.
Star Wars may pass it in 20 days.
Yeah, I mean,
which is insane.
It doubled what Avatar did in the first two, 3 weeks.
And we knew that it was going to be a massive hit. I don't know that I expected it to do that much that fast.
I don't think I expected it to be the highest grossing film of all time domestically,
especially within like a month.
Right.
I didn't expect that.
I expected that at all. But for it to almost do that, now it's not, oh gosh, will it's not, it's not if, it's when.
Oh yeah.
When will it pass Avatar? How much is it going to make? We don't really look at, you know, worldwide numbers.
Because I think it's still got a ways to go worldwide. It's got to do another like billion.
which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
But when we're talking about a movie that's been out for, you know, less than a month now. Yeah. A billion seems within reach, but it is odd how, you know, we started the year with, we talked a little bit about it in our uppies, Paddington was a very pleasant surprise from a box office standpoint. It seems like if we really wanted to do the research, there was probably just about one movie every month or every 2 months that made, you know, $200 million, and it was steady throughout the year.
Yeah.
Having two Marvel movies, that was the first time we had seen that, and they both did very well in Ant-Man and the Avengers. Again, a Hunger Games sequel. I mean, there was every time you turned around, there was a movie that was making a ton of money, whether it was Home, something that, you know, we didn't see happening at all, but a lot of huge movies, not a tremendous amount of busts.
I mean, there was your Frankenstein, and Tomorrowland would be considered because it was a $200 million. Like,
but there's nothing that's, you know, like Lone Ranger or John Carter that smelled miles away and they ended up being really bad. It seems like this year was the year of pleasant surprises. And I'll say $600 million for Jurassic World and Star Wars is a pleasant surprise.
And I think this was a good year for studio movies, like major releases, because usually my top 10 is consisted of, you know, a lot of smaller movies that you maybe have to work to see, but I didn't really reach for any of these. Like, one of them's probably a smaller movie, maybe two, but even the second one I would consider, I think it made its mark.
Yeah, I would say of my top 10, there's maybe three of them you would consider not a huge studio movie, but one of those three did get a wide theatrical release, and it did pretty well in the theaters too. And we've talked about it a lot, but yeah, I agree with you. Being a movie podcaster, you feel like you have to have that movie that maybe nobody's heard about just so you can kind of maintain your status as being cool and knowing what you're talking about. But this year, the studio films, made a lot of money because they were good.
If the stuff you're making easy to see is good, I'm fine with that. Outside of studio movies, like, it's going to be a weird year for the Oscars again, because it seems like in years past there was like three or four movies where it's like, okay, these are going to get all the noms. The last few years it's been, you know, it could go any way among these. And I feel like this year there's a lot of good performances, but I think a common thing, especially in like the award season movies, a lot of them have like they're really well made, but they're just missing something. There's a couple of the heavy hitters like Steve Jobs, Spotlight, Concussion, I think are all well-made movies with really good performances, but they're missing something. Kind of like
a one-trick pony. Those are two tricks, being well-made and having a good performance.
It just feels like they could have been better. Like, you're watching it, it's like, oh, this is a good movie. But that's it. Not like, oh, this is a great movie, when everything's there to be a great movie, and it just... Concussion especially, I think, had the power to do something, and Spotlight even. They were good, they're well acted, well put together, but they just didn't seem as powerful as they should have been. But
maybe that's just a factor of this year. Everything was so commercial that last year, if it was a year for smaller movies to do well, that was kind of the flavor of the year, was to have movies that maybe didn't make as much money, but were like Birdman. A great example. That's your best picture of the year. In no way do I think people look at that as a huge box office success, but, you know, getting the awards and the accolades that it got. Yes, last year felt like a Birdman year. This year, I don't see a movie like Birdman kind of taking over the Oscars.
Do you throw Star Wars? Does it get a Best Picture nom? Do you consider J.J. Abrams for Best Director? Like, I don't see why not. It's that saga thing to where it feels like they're going to wait until the last one, but... screw it. How do you not nominate it?
In a year where I can't really name 10 other movies that I think are that much more deserving than Star Wars. I mean, do I think it should win the Oscar for Best Picture this year? Probably not. And I'm sure when we do our Oscar pick'ems, we'll get more into that. Do I think it could be worth at least being recognized as one of the 10 best movies? Yes.
Spoiler alert,
I'm going to recognize it as one of my 10 favorite movies.
I'd love to see it. Best Picture nom. I would like to see JJ get for what the task he was given to pull it off, and I'd like to see Harrison Ford nominated.
On the one hand, there is precedent for that. I mean, Star Wars was nominated for Best Picture. Lucas was obviously nominated as Best Director, and Alec Guinness got a nomination for Best Supporting Actor. That's when the Oscars were a lot more choosy.
Yeah.
Is this movie that much worse than Star Wars in 1977? No, it's not.
So it'll be interesting. Oscars are coming up. But the tagline for this week, no one comes until he does. If you know what movie that's from.
No one wins until we tell you what the tagline is.
Hit us up, moviesonup@gmail.com, facebook.com/moviesonup, or whatever one I didn't say.
That movie's on up on the Twitter.
But enough about that. Our top 10 movies of the year. There will probably be some crossover because we didn't go through these. But when it came down to it, all through the year, if I see a movie I enjoy, I mark it down. And coming up on the end of the year, it's like, yeah, I guess I'll pick 10. But when I sat down to do my list, I usually do like, okay, these are going to be the top. These are, if I have to fill out the top 10, these are that second tier. And then these are ones that I'm okay not mentioning. My 1 through 10, I love all of these movies. And it's a good year for, like, I could rewatch all of these anytime. You know, one year I had Snowtown really high. I don't want to watch that movie over and over again because it's terrifying. But this year it's like, my 2 through 10 are almost interchangeable. I'm shocked the movies I liked, I really, really liked. And the second tier ones that are good but just maybe don't have the rewatchability factor of a 1 through 10. But I was shocked how much I enjoy my top 10 this year.
Obviously, I like all my top 10. That's why they're on the top 10. But for me, there's a very distinct gap between 5 and 6. 5 are movies that absolutely I will watch probably at the drop of a hat. That's how much I like them. And then, you know, 6 through 10 are movies that I like, movies that, you know, maybe eventually down the line I'll purchase and I'll own. I'm sure some of them I'll see again. But I liked a lot of movies. It was much harder for me to determine what was going to go in that 6 through 10 because there were probably at least another 5-10 movies that could have gone there. But I knew it. When it was a movie that belonged in the top 5, I knew it. And it just so happens that there were 5 that really, really stood out for me. But I liked a lot.
And that's how it is for me usually, where the 1 through 5 are strong and then 5 through 10 are just kind of in there. I feel so strongly about my top 10 this year, but enough about how strongly we feel about our top 10s. Ryan, what is your 10th favorite movie of last
2015.
Year?
Yes. Whatever year that was. I'll pick you up, at least for this episode and maybe the next two. My number 10 is a number 8. It is Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight with Sammy Jackson et al. I think at some point I've said on this podcast how much I like Tarantino, how much I'm kind of a shill for what he does. I think when Hateful Eight came out, I don't ever recall being as laissez-faire about seeing a Quentin Tarantino movie as I was for this one. To me, it felt or it looked like I had sort of seen this before. And maybe it's just because it's a Western and Django is a Western. They're not the same movie. But it felt like he was sort of making the same movie. And I was wrong in that. After seeing The Hateful Eight, and the reason I really wanted to see it was not as much Tarantino, but Nicotero. And people die in this movie, and they die horribly, and they explode. And the blood in it is right up there with
Damien Bichard's death. Ridiculous.
Oh, my God. Any one of them, really. Spoiler alert, this is pretty much as close to a...
It's a grindhouse type movie.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's
as close as, yeah.
The blood in it feels very much like Planet Terror. This whole, the whole story does seem a bit, it's like a Greek tragedy. It doesn't really turn out well for anybody. So to tell you this character dies, well, I got news for you. They all do. But Channing Tatum's death was really... And it was the way it was shot, I loved too. It got me a little bit re-energized about Tarantino as a filmmaker that's not just writing the ridiculously snappy dialogue. Because the dialogue was good, but it wasn't Tarantino good. This, to me, was more of him actually crafting shots and not just being a clever writer.
Yeah, this one, I think I've outgrown Tarantino to a point. Like, I respect and admire him. I think as far as like modern films go, he's the one that people are going to be talking about 50, 60 years from now. I think he's doing such unique stuff, and his stuff really is masterful. This felt weird because his movies are so different from one to the other. So to do this right after Django, where it kind of felt like a Django-type movie, felt a little off. I didn't want to mention Channing Tatum because... That was a surprise to me. I did not expect Channing Tatum in there.
You're doing the math, and they say, you know, it's The Hateful Eight, and you're counting, and there's 8 of them in a room, and Tatum's not one of them. But there are some characters that are just the way it was done. Everything was referenced, and you knew some bad shit happened, and then in Tarantino style, they'll flashback and show you exactly the terrible shit that happened.
And that's my problem with this movie, is that it's long. It's 2 hours and 47 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
It needed an hour lost. And where you were talking about how he spent time mastering the shots, that's when the movie got good. I feel like there's an hour and a half of filler in there, where if you cut that in half, you have a two-hour movie.
And most of that's dialogue that
it's
can be taken
all
out. Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino dialogue, because I had lost interest until you get to the jump back in time. That's when I got back into it. If you start there or get there not 2 hours into the movie, I feel it's a much better
movie.
My number 10, one that I was really excited about, and it did not disappoint me, directed by F. Gary Gray. It is Straight Outta Compton, the NWA biopic starring O'Shea Jackson, Corey Hawkins, Jason Mitchell, Paul Giamatti. I really love this movie. For a biopic, I'm not really a big fan of them usually, but I do enjoy NWA. I like Ice Cube. I like Dre. I like Eazy-E. So seeing their story kind of unfold, and it's a biopic about a group of people, so I didn't get tired of anybody. So you have your Eazy-E rise, you have your NWA, you have your Ice Cube, you have your Dre. I like that it was all that, and damn, if this movie wasn't wonderfully acted. Like, I think F. Gary Gray did a fantastic job, like, pacing the movie, bouncing around from the timeline that they did. But Jason Mitchell is Eazy-E, and even O'Shea Jackson and Corey Hawkins is Ice Cube. I mean, O'Shea Jackson's playing his dad. But he did really, really good. And at no point did I think, oh, he got the job because he's Ice Cube's kid. No, he's really good. And there's a point where each of them carry the movie. It's essentially an ensemble movie, but they each have their moment to where that movie's on their shoulders for 20, 30 minutes at a time. And if any one of them kind of fall flat, the whole movie's going to suffer. And they don't. I mean, I think the three of those guys, you're going to see their names a lot coming up. And I know Hawkins and Mitchell are in Skull Island, I think, coming up. Like, I think they're going to be working quite a bit. And F. Gary Gray kind of had scripts just thrown at him after this, could do anything he wanted. And I'm all for that because it was good. And, you know, Tupac is one of my favorite musicians of all time, and there is a Tupac movie coming out. I hope it gets the care that this did. I hope it gets the attention to detail because it's good. I mean, this movie was really, really good. It captures a moment in time that, you know, I lived through. I remember the Rodney King and everything leading up to that. So it was just a very cool historical movie.
And I feel like with the reception that it got, I mean, people liked that movie. So I can't imagine that a studio would not give the Tupac story its due diligence, knowing that it can be at least commercially successful. And who knows, next month it might even be critically successful as well. My number 9 is a movie that is probably going to start a little bit of a trend here on my list, and it is of sequels, maybe even rebooty sequels. My number 9 is Ryan Coogler's Creed, starring Michael B. Jordan, Sly Stallone, and Tessa Thompson. Ever since I heard that Michael B. Jordan was going to be playing Apollo Creed's son, I was like, yes, absolutely. When Rocky Balboa was announced, I thought, oh, I don't know if I really need this. But that movie really pleasantly surprised me. At no point was I off the Creed bandwagon. When it was announced that the guy that directed Fruitvale Station was going to direct Michael B. Jordan again, I thought, okay, perfect. This movie is going to be acted phenomenally. It was, not just from Michael B. Jordan, who's, if you had any doubts, maybe after seeing Fantastic Four and
awkward moment.
Right. If you had any doubts about whether or not this kid is a bona fide movie star or if he's as good as we seem to say he is, you see this movie and you know he's that damn good. Oh, yeah. And I give Stallone a lot of credit. We give him a lot of shit for being kind of a one trick pony with Rocky and then, you know, not having really any kind of performances since then. He just kind of became an action hero and a bankable movie star, and goodness knows there's worse things you can do with your life than that. But I think he actually, in the last two turns as Rocky, with this and Rocky Balboa, I think he actually has shown range, and he showed the evolution of this character that we've known, obviously, been around longer than I have.
Yeah, longer than I have.
Right. I mean, since 1976, you know, this is a character that has absolutely evolved through these movies. And just the scene where there's the line in the trailer, like, you know, I fight, you fight, kind of that scene where they have their heart to heart. I don't think I'm giving too much away when I say Rocky gets sick in the movie, but his scene there where he explains where he's coming from, it's heartbreaking, and it's great acting from a guy that we give no credit for being any kind of an actor. So based on the two leads It's just phenomenal. I mean, I guess there was boxing in the movie, but I didn't care.
Yeah, and Creed's also my number nine, so I'll just kind of piggyback off of that. Everything you said, I think Stallone will get an Oscar nom. I think he deserves it. Michael B. Jordan, we've been saying for a while, is a movie star, and he proves it. Like, he carries this movie. He's going toe-to-toe with Sylvester Stallone, and there's no drop-off there. And Tessa Thompson is going to blow up. Like, she burst out in this movie. She was fantastic, is the love interest. And you're going to be seeing a lot of her coming up in the future. Like, and Ryan Coogler, that guy can tell a story. And I know you mentioned, like, the boxing, much like Rocky Balboa, and Creed. Slow, yeah. If you look at that as a trilogy, they're not about boxing. Mm-hmm. They're about boxers. 2 through 5, that's where the boxing kind of took over. But when you look at this, the boxing is amazing in it. The boxing fight scenes, fantastic. And Coogler, I mean, that's a big jump off from Fruitvale Station and stuff we've seen from Coogler in the past, because it's essentially directing an action movie in small bursts, and there's a single shot that's phenomenal. There will be a Creed 2. The only thing that worries me, Coogler, he's going to do Black Panther. He's a perfect director for Black Panther. Do you wait a couple years to let him do Creed 2, or do you move on and see Creed? I think it's win-win. Like, if you replace him with a competent director, I do want to see more of Michael B. Jordan in this role. I would love to see Coogler do it, but Marvel, he's going to be tied down to Marvel for the next 3 years or so.
And that's kind of what happens to these directors. Like, you know, you do a smaller movie, you show some competence, and then Marvel snatches you up, and you're making $300-400 million movies for, you know, the next couple of years. But that's okay.
And I mean, I would say I was pleasantly surprised by this movie, but we were on board from the beginning.
Absolutely.
And I mean, I love boxing. Like, I'm a boxing guy, and this is what I love about boxing, because that's where, like, boxing struggles now, is you don't have the characters. And that's why I like boxing movies, because you get that character. And Donis Johnson is a character, and he's fantastic. And his interaction with the restaurant owner, Rocky Balboa, amazing. So just fantastic movie.
It's going to be a little bit of a tough transition to go from, like, Creed was necessarily a heavy movie, but I mean, it wasn't, you know, like a fun romp by any stretch of the imagination. But my number 8 certainly is, and it is the first of somewhat of a trilogy that I've got on here, and it's Paul Feig's Spy, starring Melissa McCarthy, Rose Byrne, and Jude Law. As on board to Creed as we were to start the year, I was as anti this movie as could be humanly possible. I like Melissa McCarthy. I don't love her to the point where I will stop what I'm doing and see any of her movies. But this one was really, really good. I do have to give credit where credit is due. She was very funny in it. I thought Statham stole
the show. Every scene he's in,
I could honestly just watch, like, on a daily basis, his rants from this movie. And it would take you, you know, 3 minutes to watch all of them. But those 3 minutes are so funny. And so the intensity that you know Statham for, he delivers these comedic lines with. Like, he's absolutely the same character from The Transporter or whatever. Like, he's that guy, but he's saying the most ridiculous shit.
Oh, yeah. He steals every scene in this movie.
I like Rose Byrne. More of her, the better. It's not the Melissa McCarthy character you think it's, or at least I thought it was going to be. So in that respect, I was pleasantly surprised to see that. It was a fun movie. You know, this year, a lot of the movies I liked ended up just being, oh, I'll put this on, you know, on a Saturday afternoon when I'm cleaning the house or whatever. There's enough visual comedy that I'll laugh. Or if I happen to be in another room and I hear Statham talk about his arm that fell off and then he, like, glued it back on or whatever, like, that makes me laugh just thinking about it.
This was much higher up my list, but like I said, my 1 through 10 are almost interchangeable. This was originally my number 4, but I'll go ahead and talk about it now at number 8. I'm more of a sucker for McCarthy. Tammy was really bad. I won't give her a pass for that, but...
And I didn't really care for Identity Thief.
Identity Thief I wasn't into, but I loved The Heat. I thought The Heat was fantastic with her and Sandra Bullock. I'm excited for The Boss with her and Kristen Bell. That trailer, I think, looks fantastic. So I was on board for this, and it was good. Jude Law's great in it. The 50 Cent cameo, awesome. That's second to Statham in the whole movie. Statham is worth watching this movie just for him. Because, you know, he came up doing a little bit of comedy with Lock, Stock, and Snatch, but he wasn't the comedic relief in those movies. He's the comic relief in a movie starring a Melissa McCarthy, and he nails it. Like, he's going against one of the biggest banking comedic actresses, and he's the comedic relief, and he commits to it. Like you said, he's, you know, he commits to it just like it's one of the Crank movies or Transporter, and it's so good. She's so good, like, because there's a character there. Like, she's actually, she's playing a character, and she does that well because she does bring good heart to stuff to where you actually care about Susan Cooper as a person. And then when her friend comes to find her, it's just a silly, goofy, just fun movie. And I absolutely loved it. But yeah, that I'll say it's my number eight.
My number seven is also a spy movie. I was just thinking, oh man, we probably should have done a collective because we're having a lot more crossover than I thought. But I know that we're not going to have crossover on my number seven because you haven't seen it. Or any of the 23 sequels before it. And that is Sam Mendes's Spectre, starring, of course, Daniel Craig and Christoph Waltz. I thought this was absolutely destined for my top five. Sam Mendes is back to direct another Bond after, as much as I liked Skyfall and the rest of the free world loved it, Daniel Craig's back. You've got Christoph Waltz, who is an Oscar winner.
The villain.
The guy that was born to play a Bond villain. Is playing perhaps the quintessential Bond villain. Yeah, but somehow the movie just didn't quite live up. And I think a lot of people will point to some of the self-referential bits as to why it maybe doesn't stand up as well as Skyfall. Skyfall had its bits of Bond fan service for sure. And I like that kind of stuff. I don't penalize a movie for referencing things that I like about other movies in the same series, which that may come up again later. I wish I could tell you exactly where I thought Spectre didn't measure up, and maybe it just became a victim of my own expectations for it, because it is probably my second favorite movie franchise, and it's certainly had its ups and its downs, and probably more downs than ups. And I really thought that with this actor and this director, which you never see, you don't really see a director coming back to do two, let alone two in a row. I really thought that we were on to something, and it's still a good movie, and I still like it. I'll buy it, I'll watch it, and I'll enjoy it. But to be honest with you, I will probably forget in a couple years that Spectre came out the same year as even some movies below it on my list.
I don't have much to add to that because I haven't seen it. It was originally my number eight, but now it's my number seven. I assume this one will be crossover, too. I assume it's on your list somewhere. It is starring Paul Rudd, directed by Peyton Reed. It is Ant-Man. Of the two Marvel movies this year, only one of them made my top 10. It's this one. I absolutely love Paul Rudd. Scott Lang was always a cool character, but never really one that I was nuts about. Mix him and Hank Pym, and you add Evangeline Lilly in there. And Corey Stoll as Darren Cross, who I thought was a good villain but underused. I thought he was very evil, which was a cool thing to see from a Marvel villain, but very underused. But it was just fun. Much like Spy. You talked about Spy just being something to throw on, kill some time on a Saturday afternoon. This is a fun heist movie with superhero elements to it. I like that Captain America saved the world. The Avengers saved the world. All the Marvel movies are so high stakes. This was, I gotta save my daughter. And I like that. It was on a smaller scale. There's no pun intended there. It was everything I love about Marvel movies on a more personal level. It's the first time we've had a superhero that actually has a family, other than Hawkeye. But it's a family that's relevant to the story, and he's not your highly trained soldier. He's not a super soldier. He's not an assassin.
He doesn't even really, I mean, he doesn't have superpowers.
No.
It's like a bit like Iron Man. It's 100% his suit, and what makes him is what makes him the superhero.
Yeah. I just really loved Michael Pena, stole every scene he's in. Evangeline Lilly was fantastic. I cannot wait for Ant-Man and the Wasp, like, to let her run free and give her something more to do. because I thought she did awesome with what she was done. And Paul Rudd, I mean, he got writing credit on this. He's going to be writing Ant-Man and the Wasp. He's so talented. He's so damn charming that I will watch him in as many I can't wait for Civil War.
As many ant peoples.
Yes, any movie with him playing an insect-sized superhero, I will see.
And I do like that as many Marvel movies as we get, they all seem to have their own flavor. And Ant-Man certainly had the heist movie flavor, much different than the other Marvel movie, which is on my list, and I'll talk about here in a minute. My number six, though, a better segue would have been from this Marvel movie to that one, but I'm going to go from this Michael Peña movie to this one. It is my number six. It's Ridley Scott's The Martian, starring, of course, Matt Damon, and pretty much Matt Damon and Mars, Jessica Chastain, Michael Peña, in the crew there. This movie, my girlfriend kind of put it perfectly when she said that the thing that is the most scary is not necessarily being on a ship with an alien. Because whether or not you believe in aliens, like, I mean, that's probably not going to happen. But being alone, being completely isolated, whether it's on Mars or in the forest, you know, on the side of a road that people don't really drive on, I mean, that's terrifying. And this movie wasn't a horror movie, but in reality, what could possibly be scarier than that? The thing that stood out to me the most about this movie was just how goddamn charming Matt Damon is. He'll be forever linked, for good or for bad, with Ben Affleck. And if someone told me I had to watch a movie that was going to be 2 hours of just Ben Affleck, I would not watch that film. But on the other hand, 2 hours and whatever it was with Matt Damon was a breeze. And a lot of it is down to the writing, too. It had some pretty good source material to go from, but to convey the highs of that character and the lows as well, when catastrophe hits him time after time, and he's able to not only bounce back from that, but keep up some kind of positivity where at the end of the movie, he's cracking Iron Man joke. He was really, really great in that movie, and people, justifiably so, aren't in love with the movies that Ridley Scott makes now. Back in the day, if you said Ridley Scott was going to make a space movie, that's all you needed to say, and people would know that it was great. And this, to me, got back to what made Ridley Scott a great filmmaker, is his ability to make you feel so alone and so isolated in these huge shots. It was a great movie from a guy that's a really good director, and it's good to see that he can still do that.
This movie actually was number six on my list, so I'm going to go ahead and go with that and just rearrange stuff later. I loved this movie so much. You know, you do a movie like Castaway with Tom Hanks, and it's tough because you're putting one person on screen for that long. Matt Damon pulled it off. His character is fantastic, and he's witty. It's shot well with the cameras because it makes sense. He's all he has to talk to, so it makes sense that he's documenting as much. But you take that performance, and then you throw in Jessica Chastain, Kate Mara, Sebastian Stan, Donald Glover, Jeff Daniels, Kristen Wiig, Chiwetel Ejiofor, like, that cast is ridiculous, and they all get a chance to do something. It's not just Matt Damon and the E Street Band. Like, they all have their time to shine, and Michael Peña has some good scenes. Jessica Chastain, like, you see the emotion of what happened, and you see Jeff Daniels going through this. Sean Bean, I didn't even mention. He's really, really good. It's awesome because it's not just hard on Matt Damon. Obviously, he's the one that's trapped on Mars, but the turmoil that everybody else goes through to try to get him home, it's such a good movie. At times, I forgot it's a Ridley Scott movie because that's what my opinion of Ridley Scott has become, to where I don't consider him in that upper echelon of
But that's great that, like, we talk about directors getting in their own way.
Yes,
and being
this,
like,
did not feel like a Ridley Scott movie.
Right, yeah.
No.
He didn't have a style he had to make. He just made a really good
movie. He made a really, really good movie. And it's a watchable movie. It's so
watchable.
I could watch this over and over again. This is one of those, when it comes on the movie channels, if it's on, I'm turning it on at any point, because at no point does it drag. At no point does it get too heavy or too light. Like, it's just so evenly toned the whole time. And some of the interactions, like, The whole world's watching what you type. Oh, really? And like, just one of my favorite exchanges is him explaining the whole space pirate thing.
Yeah.
And then Mackenzie Davis says, like, well, he wants to be called Captain Blondebeard. And he's
well,
like,
it is under maritime law.
Yeah, he explained it. Like, it just, there's so many good exchanges like that. I adored this movie way more. I expected it to be good because I like Matt Damon, but I did not expect to love it the way I loved it.
My number five is the aforementioned Marvel movie that is on my list, and it is Joss Whedon's The Avengers Dos, Age of Ultron, starring Robert Downey Jr. and the crew. At this point, you know who they are. When Avengers came out, God knows, we spent most of the first year of our podcast just drooling all over that movie because it was really, really good. And pretty much everything I like about the first movie, and the thing that I think to both of us stands out about the first movie is how much everybody really got their chance to shine. It wasn't just Captain America or whoever you want in the E Street Band, to use the analogy from The Martian, but everybody really gets an opportunity. And in Age of Ultron, you're adding in more characters on the good side, and you also have Ultron, this villain that Hiddleston was great as Loki in the Avengers, but I think he was probably outdone by Spader in this movie. And then you add in the twins, who had some great scenes. Bet you didn't see that coming. Is to this point one of
the highlight of the Marvel Universe,
right? And they've had plenty of highlights, and that just, that stands out. And Hawkeye's storyline in this one, as much as I praised the first Avengers for utilizing every character, and no matter who you were sitting in the audience, if you were a fan of Quicksilver or whoever's your favorite hero, if they're in that movie, you get some time to really enjoy your favorite hero not only kicking ass, but having some really important scenes in that movie. I love that, to where the movie doesn't seem thrown together like, oh my God, we have to use all these characters because they make money and we need to get them all together to make all the money. It seems like it is organic, to the point where, oh, of course, you know, the situation is so dire, all these heroes do need to get together, and then it makes sense that they're all together, and they're used well. Nobody felt shoehorned in just because, Hawkeye sells some books, so let's get him in there so the Hawkeye fans will like it or whatever. I think that has a lot to do almost exclusively with Whedon directing it and writing a large portion of it. I wish that Joss Whedon could just direct Avengers movies from here on out, because I feel really comfortable with, and I've always felt really confident in his ability to do that. To me, it's always such a feat that he manages to work all these characters in. A bit like we said with Coogler, maybe not directing Creed 2, will it be as good? I am a little concerned about what may happen in another Avengers movie not helmed by Joss Whedon.
You know what, though? I think Captain America Winter Soldier is so beautifully directed by the Russo brothers.
Good, yeah.
But I mean, we'll get the test. We essentially get an Avengers movie in a couple of months, and we'll get to see how they handle all the storylines in Civil War. I hope they handle it well, because we have two Avengers movies from them after that. Avengers 2 was good. I'm not going to sit here and say I didn't love it, because I did. Do I like it less the more I think on it? It's a mess at times. Where I talked about Hateful Eight needed to be like an hour shorter, I feel like this needed like an extra half an hour. What happened to Thor? Where'd he go? What are you doing, dude? You just in a pool? Like,
we'll find out.
Yeah. So
Thor, Ragnarok.
I felt it was a mess at times. It felt a little rushed at points. I do like the comic booky plot. I'm going to pick up a city and drop it on the world to extinct it. That's fantastic. It almost got too Whedon-y as far as the sense of humor goes, because I do like all the Marvel movies have humor thrown in. This was almost, the witty banter was almost a little too much. Like, every line was a joke of some sort, it seemed. But it was good. I'm not going to say, I'm just trying to nitpick at this point, because it didn't make my top 10. It was on there. It would be 11. Like, it got knocked out because late. It would be 11. I did like it. I'll watch it numerous times in the future. But my number five, it's from one of my favorite screenwriters making his directorial debut. It is from earlier this year, Ex Machina, written and directed by Alex Garland, starring Oscar Isaac, Domhnall Gleeson, and Alicia Vikander. It was the year of Alicia Vikander. This movie's awesome. It's such a simple setup. Oscar Isaac's this billionaire genius. Domhnall Gleeson's this guy who Oscar Isaac wants to test out the AI, and Alicia Vikander is this sexy robot. And it's so good, and it's got your twists and turns. I'll praise Alex Garland over and over again, because 28 Days Later and Sunshine are two of my favorite movies ever, probably two of my top three favorite movies ever. This has some of that emotional roller coaster that those movies have, and it builds up to a climax that I don't really think you see that climax coming when you start the movie. I think you picture in your head a few things that could happen, and I don't know that you picture that. And then you put it together with, I think Domhnall Gleeson has one of the coolest careers right now. Everything that guy does, from Harry Potter to an episode of Black Mirror to Frank to About Time to this, like everything this guy, Star Wars, like everything is.
Oh, there's that one.
Yeah, he's in that too. Oh, The Revenant. There's so many things that this guy is doing, and I don't think he's made a bad movie yet. He's really good in it. He carries the movie, essentially. I mean, Vikander steals the show. I think she'll get an Oscar nom this year, not for this, but she will get recognition for that Eddie Redmayne movie. And everybody's so good. Everybody's what they need to be. Oscar Isaac is this guy that you want to like, but you don't trust. He pulls that off perfectly.
I'm not sure this movie, I'm not sure it actually has an antagonist.
Or a protagonist. It's pretty even keel.
Yeah, I mean, everybody, to a certain extent, you like and you sort of sympathize with. I mean, some more than others, for sure. I like this movie. I love her performance.
Oh, she's phenomenal.
To me, I think that's, it's more, like you said, with Concussion, where, like, it's a good movie, and you think it should be phenomenal. Especially with the talent from a writing-directing aspect, from an acting aspect. All three of those actors are just incredible.
Oh, they're top-notch right now.
And it's their movie. I mean, I do find it strange that this is Vikander's film, and she's going to get nominated for what you called the Eddie Redmayne movie. And justifiably so. The hell does she have to do? I guess you got to make two movies the same year that are really, really good.
And Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yeah, and just make two that are good, and that's it. I liked this movie, but I didn't love it. I don't know that it's one that I would necessarily go back and rewatch. I had my problems with some of the story, but again, maybe that feels like it's nitpicking. But I do love watching the scenes with Domhnall Gleeson and with Vikander are really, really good. There's nothing to distract you from just watching these two actors do what it is they do. Even some of the CG that's going, it doesn't take you out of it. It's phenomenal. It's great, small sci-fi movie making.
The scenes with Domhnall Gleeson and Oscar Isaac, I think, are fantastic. I love the movie. I thought it was fantastic, and it builds up. It feels like a Black Mirror episode. It's just this sci-fi kicking the balls that you don't really see coming. Yeah, and I absolutely adore this movie. It is definitely the most downery of my top 10, though.
I guess depends on whose perspective it's from. My number four is not a downer at all, although throughout most of it you are worried. But it is another small cast that absolutely just act their balls off, because there's not a lot else going on in Letty Abrahamson's Room, starring Brie Larson and that really cute little boy, or is it
Jacob
a girl?
Jacob Tremblay.
Jacob Tremblay, yeah. Admittedly, I didn't know much about this movie going in, other than a lot of it takes place in a room between Brie Larson and her son. Don't know why they were in the room. I didn't care. It didn't matter. But when you find out why they're there, it makes the story that much better. And there is so much legitimate tension about halfway through the movie that you think, oh my God, now what can possibly happen? And that's what I love about this movie, is not just what it would be like in that room, because we spend enough time with them there to know or to get a feeling of what it would be like. But then there's, all right, well, then what? And we get to see then what, and that's just as compelling as the first half of the movie.
And to me, that's where the movie really picks up, I think, because you don't see that. You've seen kidnapping stories or abduction movies. They're rescued, roll credits.
And that's the climax.
And
that's
this
not.
is the, you've missed 7 years of your life. You've raised a child in a 20 by 12 room. What happens when you're not in that room anymore? And it's really compelling, and it's really, really good. I think Brie Larson is putting together some of the best acting performances
that
right
nobody's
now.
Nobody's seeing.
Yeah, Short Term 12 should have been nominated for an Oscar. She should get nominated for an
Oscar
feel
like
for
this. One sneaks in.
I think she will. I think she'll sneak in because it's well deserved. Tremblay, for being like a little kid, is really good. It is 10, and just her emotion. There's a bunch of scenes. I hate the term, but it's a powerhouse performance. Like, for everything that she goes through in some of those scenes, there's an exchange when she's getting ready to roll him up in the carpet. I don't want to spoil anything, but, and, you know, with Grandma and Grandpa, and he's like, and with you, Mommy, and that's not part of her plan, and she's just like, yeah, and with me, and it's just, the way she delivers that, it's heartbreaking. It's delivered so well, and it's a nice movie about closure and acceptance and moving on. And it does address that very, very well. And we live real close to Cleveland, and it's very much like the Ariel Castro
scenario. I mean, the story takes place in Akron.
Yeah. And I mean, it's very much Ariel Castro, just with one woman instead of three. So, I mean, maybe it hit a little bit closer to home to me than it should have. But, man, her interview, it's just like, he's mine. He's my son. And it's so good because she's so good. H. Macy shows up for a minute. He doesn't have much to do, but what he does pretty well. It's a good movie. It was in my second tier of movies. Like, it would probably round out my top 15 or 16, but that's a fantastic movie. My number four, another fantastic movie that feels like it was made for me. I love an epic crime story. So Denis Villeneuve's Sicario kind of hit every nail on the head for me. Villeneuve has been doing phenomenal stuff between Prisoners and Enemy. He's making great movies that are talking about things, and he's getting fantastic performances like in those movies from Gyllenhaal specifically. And then this one, you have Emily Blunt, Josh Brolin, Benicio Del Toro, Victor Garber as kind of the main ones. And I mean, Emily Blunt's an action star. Emily Blunt is a movie star, and she
does Wonder Woman, right?
Captain Marvel.
I meant like that would have been the perfect choice.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah.
Of course, DC whiffed.
Yeah.
Although yeah. Gal Gadot might be great.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I mean, she's because she's more than that. Like in Edge of Tomorrow, she's not just kicking ass and taking names. Like, there's a lot there. And in this, she's really, really good because there's a lot going on within her. And the story is very cool. It's just, you know, taking on the drug cartel. And it reminds me a lot of Gone Baby Gone, where there's some choices made by people that you should respect that maybe you don't agree with, but you can see where they're coming from. And it makes sense. So it's a good moral question of which side do you fall on? Do you want to do things by the book, or do you want to cut the head off the snake? It's just really, really good. She's great. Josh Brolin, it's cool to see him in a role like this because I picture Josh Brolin just this intense. He's so intense all the time. In this one, he just kind of shows up and doesn't care. So for most actors, it would just look like they phoned it in. But for somebody as intense as him, like, he brought it. Like, he's just this carefree. And then Benicio Del Toro. I would be all for Del Toro being nominated for an Oscar for this. I don't think this movie will get much recognition when it comes to awards, which is a shame. But it's as far as crime movies go, like, I hold Heat on a pedestal. I think that's like the epitome of what a great crime epic should be. Sicario's close. There's a big crime one coming out early this year called Triple Nine that I have high hopes for. And after seeing Sicario, my crime movie expectations are really, really high, so I'm hoping it delivers. But Sicario is just such a good, good movie. And I mean, I just love watching Emily Blunt.
It's going to become apparent from my list that I love watching spy movies. And my number three is my favorite spy movie of the year. It was probably, I'm not going to say it's the least likely to be so, given that Spy was on the list, but it is Matthew Vaughn's Kingsman: The Secret Service. We have pretty much the entire year slobbered all over this movie. And if you don't know why, just listen to either our midterm episode
halftime show.
Yeah, whatever we call that. Even last week, we talked about it a little bit during the uppies. It's great, great filmmaking from a great filmmaker. Many of the things that I like and appreciate about Tarantino movies, when he wants to, Matthew Vaughn can do that just as well. He's just as visual. He's just as visceral. And the dialogue, while it's not necessarily as snappy back and forth, it doesn't have to be as quick, but it's still good. It still has all of the intelligence that some of Tarantino's stuff does have. At no point did I think that, Colin Firth is a badass. In this movie,
he's a badass.
He's absolutely a badass. And you buy it hook, line, and sinker. He is this character. He is who they say he is. Taron Egerton, who I had not seen in very much before, I'm very happy to be seeing him again in Kingsman 2. And I think he's doing
hopefully
the Robin Hood
Han
prequel. Yeah, whatever. That kid was really, really good and did a great job of, at times, carrying that movie. It wasn't really completely his load to bear. When he had to, I thought he was really, really good in this movie. And Sam Jackson, I kind of oscillate back and forth on whether I like the character that he was doing or whether I don't. But now I think I'm back more to kind of liking it. I mean, it's great. You have everything that I love about James Bond movies. This movie spoofs and spoofs with care and does a great job. You have that great Bond henchman kind of villainess.
Gazelle, who stole every scene and she's in.
Yeah, you have some great deaths there. You have, you know, him ordering drinks. It's phenomenal. You've got the gadgets. This billionaire business tycoon who's got a ridiculously overcomplicated plot to take over the world. It has everything that I love about Bond movies. With a sense of humor. A dark sense of humor, but a sense of humor.
It's a comic book Bond movie. It's everything about Bond turned up to 11. And that's why it's also my number three. We've raved about it all year. And I didn't want to mention it earlier because I knew it was high on both of our lists. But we talked about surprises throughout the year. This came out, made a lot of money, got a lot of acclaim. As much as I love Matthew Vaughn, I wasn't excited for this movie. I didn't rush out to see it. It didn't seem like something I was interested in, but I loved it. And Matthew Vaughn has still not made a movie I don't love. Egerton, I think, is great. He brought the swagger. I compared it to Charlie Cox's performance in Stardust because you see the character, where he starts and where he ends are completely different. And that's also a Matthew Vaughn movie, so that makes sense. But it's common in his movies. Look at Kick-Ass. He's great at character arcs, and I know you've said negative things about Samuel L. Jackson. I think Samuel L. Jackson is so good in this movie because he's so ridiculous. And the movie is so ridiculous. And the plot is so ridiculous. The action is so ridiculous. The deaths. Everything about this movie is just a cartoon and a caricature of everything it's supposed to be. And that's why I liked that Samuel L. Jackson performance, because it's a caricature of a Samuel L. Jackson villain performance, and I thought it fit. And I don't watch the Bond movies, so I don't love it for the nods and stuff to the Bond movies, but I'm aware enough of the Bond that I get it. And it's just a fun, damn entertaining movie.
And I agree that, at least from our perspective, it was a huge surprise, a movie that neither of us... From a director that we both love an awful lot.
I wanted him to do Star Wars.
Yeah, I did too, believe me. But a movie that we were just kind of like, we had no reason to think it'd be bad, but it still shocked us at how good it was. My number two, had it not been for my number two, Kingsman would have been the biggest surprise, the biggest pleasant surprise for me this year. But my number two was directed by Jermaine Clement and Takiya Waititi. It was, I think, is the funniest movie I've seen all year, is What We Do in the Shadows, starring Jermaine Clement and Waititi and Johnny Brew. I'm a sucker for horror movies to begin with. this was my favorite horror movie of the year. And it is a horror movie. It's like Nosferatu meets the real world. I loved the point of view this movie had. And I love that it was able to kind of poke fun at the genre. But I still think that it didn't offend anybody that would be, you know, a diehard vampire fan. I loved, let's assume vampires did exist, trying to go to a club, like they have to be invited in. Or the scene where he gets the locket from, you know, the woman he's been carrying a torch for 80 years. But he can't wear it because it's silver. So he's got these gloves and he holds it for as long as he can. I love the vampire hunters and just having like a human friend that's kind of hanging around. I thought this movie was really, really funny. Very rarely do I watch a comedy and then decide I need to see it again almost immediately. This was one that I think I maybe Redboxed or something. And then I was like, oh, hell no. I'm buying this movie. I made Amazon give it to me in like 2 days and then watched it again. And I've been telling everyone that enters my orbit how great this movie is. And I've probably pissed everyone off because inevitably when you say a comedy is really, really funny, it never ends up being as funny as you say it is. But I'm fairly comfortable telling people, if you have a similar sense of humor, what I have, I think you'll really enjoy this. I thought it was something completely different. In the horror movies that we had this year, the better ones, to me, were the funny ones because they came at things at a different angle. In a year where we got so many sequels and things that seemed somewhat formulaic or reminiscent of an earlier movie, things that were different to me really, really stood out. And whether it was Cooties or
It Follows.
Well, maybe less.
That wasn't that funny. But.
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, of the funny ones like The Final Girls, you know, things like that. This one to me stood out, and it was my favorite of all of those. And it's been one of my favorites since I saw it, like back in, I don't know, March or April, whenever I was able to see it on DVD.
My number two is also my favorite horror movie of the year. It's one that I went in with very high expectations based off of a fantastic trailer to me. The trailer reminded me a lot of Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, one of my favorite movies ever, not just horror movies. It is directed by Todd Strauss, Schulzen. It is The Final Girls, starring Taysa Farmiga, Malin Akerman, Nina Dobrev, Alia Shawkat, Thomas Middleditch, and then the two that steal the show, Adam Devine and Angela Trimber. This movie, I absolutely adored. It is a throwback. It's going to be hard not to compare it to Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, because they both are takes on the slasher genre that are doing something different with the slasher genre. They're not just straight up slashers. This one, Taysa Farmiga, her mom, former Scream Queen, starred in an 80s slasher, and then now she's dead. They go to a showing, get sucked into the movie, so she's reunited with her mom in a way. There's a lot of heart there with her and her mom. There's a lot of comedy, especially between Adam Devine and Tina. I mean, I can't stress enough how good Angela Trimber is in this movie. She gives it all. She commits 100%. Thomas Middleditch is really funny. And, you know, it doesn't really have the horror elements of it. The horror aspect of it, it's down the list of checklist, but it's hard not to consider it a horror comedy.
And I think horror fans would agree with you. They would like this movie because it caters, you know, to them. It gives you all the tropes lovingly and spoofily.
Yeah, it's not, there are no jump scares. There are no scares, really. Like, everything is telegraphed and seen a mile away.
Which, but, again, is a spoof.
Yeah, that's how movies. They are. So, the characters, I mean, that Farmiga, she does a fantastic job. It is an ensemble cast, but it's the emotional burden of the movie is put on her. She's the only one that's really dealing with any type of character issue. Malin Akerman, I thought, was really good in this. Like, this is the kind of role she's good at. The climax is great. It leads to an awesome fight scene. Really like what they did with the fight scene at the end. And I feel like it went under the radar, which is disappointing to me, because I think as far as horror and horror comedy goes, this is one of my favorite ones in a few years.
This was a good year for that, and I think most of them went under the radar.
Yeah, I mean, Cooties I thought was I thought Cooties was fantastic.
Yeah.
It maybe round out my top 20. Like, it's in my also-rans, but it's near the bottom. But Cooties was fun, but it didn't feel like a complete movie. This one, it does end where open-ended, but it's in a playful way. So I would love to see a Final Girls 2, but much like I'd love to see a Trick or Treat 2 or a Leslie Vernon 2.
We're getting a Trick or Treat 2.
Eventually, finally.
Yeah.
But it just feels like this is something I would love to see continue, but I feel like we won't. And that disappoints me because I did love this movie.
I think our one, and I'd say our one because I'm pretty sure it's the same movie, and I'm pretty sure that we're going to see a continuation of this movie. It did end very open-ended.
It's obviously Ted 2.
It is obviously Ted 2. It's Star Wars. I don't really feel the need to talk about it a ton right now. If you're disappointed by that, all you need do
tune in next week.
Yeah, come back next week where we're going to do something. It's completely unprecedented in the history of Movies on Up in 2016. It is doing an entire Star Wars episode, this time for The Force Awakens. So if for whatever reason you're the person that hasn't seen it yet, you may want to stay away from next week's episode because I'm sure there will be all sorts of spoilers and conjecture that will be lobbed back and forth. But for a movie that was my favorite movie from last year, my most anticipated, my most best everything, my BFF, Dave really liked it as well. I'm speaking for him because I know that it's his number one.
I mean, just to sum it up, it was everything I wanted and more without getting too much into it because we'll do that next week.
Sure. Anything like that we didn't mention that maybe you did want to give a kind of a nod to here and there?
It Follows, I mentioned briefly. We mentioned surprises. I left it off because I didn't know if you'd seen it yet. The Gift, written and directed by Joel Edgerton.
Yeah.
Really good movie. That was right on the cusp of my top 10 because Jason Bateman gives...
It was my 12.
It was
right after Cooties.
Yeah. Jason Bateman gives probably the best performance I've ever seen him give because it's not your funny Jason Bateman. He's despicable in this movie. Joel Edgerton, you know, he wrote and directed it, but he's not, he's the Hannibal Lecter of this movie. Like, he realizes that the kind of...
His screen time is very impactful.
Yes, the villain that he's playing, and I put that in quotes, is more impactful the less you see him.
Right.
The climax just, again, I hate to use it because if you haven't seen Black Mirror, you don't understand what this means. Felt like a Black Mirror episode. Like, it had that kind of ending to where it's just like, okay, this is going to end somehow. And then it just rips your testicles out.
And you go like, this is how it ends. This is how it ends. You're arguing with yourself for like the last 10 minutes. But yeah, that was a really good movie. It just kind of escaped the gravity of my top 10. I did like Krampus. I was kind of skeptical about that because of how much I love Trick or Treat and not had really seen a lot else that he directed. But I thought it was really good. To me, it's on the level of something like Gremlins, where, you know, every Christmas, if you don't want to show your kid Rudolph for the 38th time, you can watch Krampus. It's not, you know, it's scary. There's some, the monsters in it are really, really cool looking, and it's got a little bit of a story there. I like the narrative story. I mean, there was a flashback in it that kind of tells the history of Krampus, which I actually liked that part of the movie the best. But for liking Trick or Treat, which was an anthology and telling, you know, a couple stories that are a little bit shorter and telling them well, I was interested to see how he would do with one narrative. And I thought he pulled it off. I was very, as predictable as it was, I was very satisfied with that movie.
Krampus and Night Before, like, probably the only two that I really wish I'd have seen because I think I expect to like them really well. Steve Jobs and Spotlight, well-made movies that just felt like they were lacking something. I liked the new Terminator. Maybe it was because I saw it with my best friend since fifth grade, who I first saw Terminator 2 with. It was everything I wanted from a Terminator movie. True Story and Cop Car were two smaller ones that came out that I really liked. Cooties, Minions, and Trainwreck with LeBron. I just had to mention it because...
Yeah, I obviously agree with you. Cooties, I think we've given a little bit of love to. Minions for sure got some last week, so I don't feel bad leaving that off the list, although I did like it. And Trainwreck was good. It wasn't my favorite comedy of the year.
No.
It was maybe top three favorite of the year. Certainly What We Do in the Shadows and Spy. I liked a lot more. But I thought it was a good movie. And I think LeBron and John Cena absolutely
steal that movie. And I mean, it Apatow's, even though he didn't write it.
And Pitch Perfect, too. That was good, too.
Anything off top of your head just for 2016 that you're looking forward to?
I mean, it's hard to see that trailer for Civil War and not get super pumped. That's not necessarily the most original answer. But, of course, I'm excited for that. It's going to be interesting to see, like, literally how things go, because you have everything last year was Star Wars. So, you know, in coming up in 2 years, it's going to be Star Wars again. So if studios are going to start to figure out, you have to go in the odd Star Wars years where you get like a
Rogue One.
Yeah, you get a smaller Star Wars movie that's still going to make $300 million. But I'm kind of interested to see how that pattern starts to form. You know, what happens with Justice League? I don't know that I'm interested in. I'm going to see it. I'm not necessarily excited to see it. I'm excited to see what happens.
Yeah.
Not in the movie.
No.
But, like, what happens going forward with that
Batman versus Superman, the latest trailer, looks like something I'll see, but not something I'm excited for. The 999 I mentioned earlier, I think that looks fantastic. The Nice Guys, the new Shane Black movie with Gosling and Russell Crowe, I think looks amazing. And obviously Rogue One, Civil War. And I'm sure there's stuff I'm missing in there, but just off the top of my head, those are the ones that,
we'll do that when we do, like, the preview episode.
Those are the ones that jump out to me. So, I mean, is it a hangover year? We talked about
almost by default, it has to be.
We talked about 2014 being, like, the appetizer to 2015. So, is this going to be, like, a hangover year, or are we going to have some big surprises come out? But either way, that was 2015. I think that episode was about a year long, about as long as 2015. But I had fun. You had fun. Ryan had fun. I'm speaking for all of us here.
We all had fun.
Yeah. But next week, we'll be back. We'll talk Force Awakens full time. So until then,
keep it up.
That felt like it went way long.